South Africa, all of these countries that have historically supported Palestinian liberation in Africa will continue to toe this line, because it is not just a question of it's a question of history, it's a question of solidarity, it's a question of shared experiences of all of these systemic types of violence.
And Nangella, we only have less than a minute left, but I wanted to ask you about all of the heightened anti-colonial sentiment that has swept across Central Africa and the Sahel region, with numerous coups in the region in recent years. How has this affected the dynamics at the AU?
It's definitely complicated things, and there's probably three things that I would point out. One is that this is not happening in a vacuum. We are also feeling the secondary effects of the ongoing war in Ukraine, Russia's ongoing war in Ukraine. The Sahel region has historically attracted a great deal of attention because it has been the crossroads of trade between Africa and Europe, but it's also been, in contemporary history, the main pathway through which migrants from as far afield as Bangladesh, but also from the continent, cross the Mediterranean to get into southern Europe. So in terms of international diplomacy, it's attracted a great deal of attention from Europe. There's a great deal of financing for migration management. There's a great deal of financing for ending wars that have happened in the region. At the same time, you have this young generation. Remember that Africa is the youngest continent in the world. You have this young generation, many of these cool leaders.
Nangella, we're going to have to wrap there, but we're going to continue and post online at democracynow.org. Nangella,
you are listening to KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. This month's Development Committee meeting will be held on Monday, February 26th at 4:30 p.m. The meeting will be held online through a public video conference. A public link and phone number to attend the meeting can be found on our website at kboo.fm. Please visit our website to verify if a meeting is being held.
Tune in to KBOO throughout February, every Tuesday at 7 p.m. for Black History Future Month, our special programming series in celebration of Black heritage. This series aims to celebrate all aspects of the Black lived experience, from contemporary, political, and social issues to understanding how history impacts our present. Again, that's Black History Future Month, every Tuesday at 7 p.m. throughout the month of February, where you will hear interviews from Black creatives, artists, activists, revolutionaries, KBOO hosts, musicians, and more, here on your community radio station, KBOO Portland.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Multnomah County Jail deputies were involved in more than a dozen inmate assaults in 2018 and 2019, according to a new report.
Portland's downtown library is reopened.
And in international news, the United States vetoes a ceasefire resolution at the UN.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 21st. I'm James Neal.
And I'm Michelle Coppola. Multnomah County Corrections deputies encouraged and in some cases participated in more than a dozen assaults of inmates in the county's downtown jail in 2018 and 2019. That's according to an investigation by Oregon State Police released by the county today. It discovered a pattern of misconduct where jail deputies did favors for members of the Hoover Gang. That included things like running drugs, bringing in contraband, and buzzing inmates into cells to beat up their rivals. These claims come from written complaints, recorded jail phone calls from the time, and interviews with current and former jail staff. The report was submitted to county prosecutors, but in November, they decided not to press criminal charges against three of the deputies involved, saying they didn't think they could prove the charges. The deputies were Gustavo Volandvino, Mirzet Sakharovic, and George Trout. They were put on administrative leave in late 2022. Willamette Week first started pressing for documentation through public records requests in June of 2022. The events in question happened in 2018 and 2019, and the sheriff's office had the 142-page report for nearly a year before turning it over to the paper and publishing the report on its website. Sheriff Nicole Morrissey O'Donnell says she has, quote, initiated a professional standards investigation into the three deputies named in that report.
Multnomah County's Central Library downtown reopened today after being closed for almost a year for a $13 million improvement. The bookshelves in the first floor reading room are lower, allowing in more sunlight. There are also changes in the color scheme from pink to shades of yellow and gold to brighten the rooms. Bookshelves are now on wheels to make it easier for staff to rearrange spaces for events. But the biggest change may be the restrooms, which are now much larger, refurbished, and brightly lit. Library spokesperson Sean Cunningham noted, quote, particularly for this community in downtown Portland, having access to clean, safe, and welcoming restrooms is something that a lot of folks just can't find anywhere else. The Central Library was last renovated in the mid-90s, only more extensively, including the central black granite staircase. Six other library branches are still closed for renovations, with four of those, Fairview, Columbia, Hillsdale, Holgate, Midland, all expected to reopen this summer.
The Portland School Board has voted to go ahead with plans to relocate the district headquarters and sell their existing building to Albina Vision Trust. Albina Vision Trust is a nonprofit that's focused on improving the historically black Albina neighborhood, including the area around PPS headquarters. They have plans to turn the property off the Broadway Bridge on the east side of the river into housing, a park, and an educational hub, among other plans. It overlooks the Willamette River, and Albina Vision Trust sees it as a key opportunity to transform the Albina neighborhood. The plan has benefits for the school district as well. J.T. Flowers with Albina Vision Trust explained in an Instagram video posted by the organization.
The argument's pretty straightforward. PPS recently commissioned a relocation study. What they found is that staying in place would actually cost the district anywhere from $14 to $81.5 million. Staying in place is quite literally costing our students and teachers money that our district does not have. So they have to relocate. The question is how and where. If they build a new headquarters building, it's going to cost them over $100 million. If they renovate an existing building, it's going to cost them over $100 million. So their only option is to buy a building, one that's virtually turnkey ready right now. Lucky for us, we got a once-in-a-generation real estate market opportunity on the west side of the river. It would allow PPS to buy a brand new transit-accessible building with on-site parking for pennies on the dollar. The only cost-neutral option for relocation. The only option that doesn't continue to siphon money away from our students and teachers. And that's not even mentioning the restorative redevelopment it would catalyze in Lower Albina.
That was J.T. Flowers with the Albina Vision Trust explaining the benefit of the plan to Portland Public Schools in an Instagram video. Albina Vision Trust will also help PPS find a new location. In fact, they've proposed 14 possibilities already. The school board passed a resolution to move forward at a meeting on Tuesday. It outlines that the board has a year to identify a new location and must spend 60 days on the minimum criteria for the new headquarters and warehouse sites. Julia Brim Edwards is a PPS board member. She said of the resolution, quote, this is a great day. I'm really looking forward to it. I think that's a huge commitment for PPS to make. It's a long time coming, end quote.
Southern resident orcas are now listed as endangered in Oregon. The decision comes with next steps for recovering the important animal population. KBOO's Joseph has more on this story.
The Oregon Fish and Wildlife Commission has decided to list southern resident orcas as endangered species. With it comes guidelines for how the decision will protect these whales. There are only about 74 animals left in this population of West Coast whales. Ben Intiknap is Pacific Project Manager and a senior scientist with Oceana. He says ensuring the orcas have enough salmon to eat is the main barrier, and the federal government, Washington state, tribes, and the public sector were working on this prior to Oregon's listing decision.
What this does is really prioritize Oregon's work on this issue of recovering salmon and adds another layer of understanding and reason for why we need to be doing this now and doing it more urgently than is already being done.
Intignap says Oregon's listing could help the state get more resources from the federal government for salmon recovery. Southern resident orcas are already listed as endangered on the federal level and by Washington state. The endangered listing in Oregon comes with guidelines for how to recover the species. That includes addressing pollutants and reducing noise disturbance by educating boaters about buffer zones around orcas. The guidelines also instruct the state to enhance hatchery production of Chinook salmon if possible. Intignap says the orcas feed on Chinook at the mouth of the Columbia River in the winter and spring.
To really have a long-term sustainable fix, we need to be investing in wild salmon recovery. And that means doing things like river restoration, dam removal, sustainable harvest limits, and things like that that can help these Chinook salmon populations recover.
Intignap says removing dams on Columbia River tributaries could help the fish. He also notes that warmer waters and lower snowpack from climate change are increasingly impacting salmon populations, which is also hurting southern resident orcas. For KBOO Evening News and the Oregon News Service, I'm Joseph.
On to Salem, where the Oregon Senate passed a bill on Tuesday that would give consumers more options to repair home appliances and electronic devices. The bill received wide bipartisan support, but it still has to pass the House before making its way to the governor's desk for approval. At present, tech manufacturers only provide tools and know-how for electronic device repair to a limited network of technicians, and this raises prices. Senate Bill 1596 would change that. It would require manufacturers to offer tools, parts, devices, and any documentation needed to repair devices at a, quote, fair price and on, quote, reasonable terms to small repair shops and owners themselves, who could then make the repairs. Oregon's bill also addresses parts pairing software, which limits how people can have their devices repaired by locking them out of certain fixes if they don't have manufacturer-approved parts. Under this bill, tech manufacturers wouldn't be allowed to use parts pairing if it caused a device to lose functions or led to, quote, unnecessary or misleading alerts or warnings during repair. The state attorney general could sue companies who aren't in compliance. This bill is the fourth attempt at enacting this type of legislation since 2019. Previous versions were challenged by various tech companies, but this time Google has offered tacit support, testifying last month that this version was a, quote, inclusive compromise, while Intel, Amazon, and Microsoft stayed neutral. Apple remains opposed.
The U.S. vetoed the U.N. Security Council's third attempt to pass a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. On Tuesday, 13 of the 15 council members voted in favor, with the United Kingdom abstaining. Algeria's ambassador to the U.N., Amar Benjama, who'd put forward the ceasefire resolution 2 weeks ago, said, quote, "Voting against it implies an endorsement of the brutal violence and collective punishment inflicted upon the Palestinian people." U.S. Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield said, quote, "Demanding an immediate and unconditional ceasefire without an agreement requiring Hamas to release the hostages will not bring endurable peace." The U.S. Senate recently passed a bill to send Israel more than $14 billion in unconditional military aid, more than triple what the U.S. has been sending most years. But Congress is refusing to consider the bill, which also gives military aid to Ukraine and Taiwan. Last night, President Biden attended a high-dollar fundraiser at the home of influential pro-Israel billionaire Haim Saban.
The U.S. rejects a U.N. resolution on Israel-Gaza ceasefire, but proposes a different one. Some Democrats vote against Biden to protest his policy on Gaza, and a California woman is being held in Russia. With more on those stories, it's Edwin J. Vieira with 2024 Talks.
Welcome to 2024 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times. The draft resolution has not been adopted owing to the negative vote of a permanent member of the council.
Ambassador Carolyn Rodriguez-Burkett of Guyana now in the rotating presidency of the UN Security Council. Despite most of the council backing a Gaza ceasefire resolution, the U.S. vetoed it, instead backing one more closely tied to the release of the hostages. Nearly 30,000 Palestinian civilians have died in 5 months of war, two-thirds of whom are women and children. But UN Ambassador Linda Thomas-Greenfield says the failed resolution could interfere with hostage negotiations.
While we cannot support a resolution that would put sensitive negotiations in jeopardy, we look forward to engaging on a text that we believe will address so many of the concerns we all share.
The White House is becoming more publicly critical of Israel and is pressing to stop an offensive into southern Gaza. Israel says it will go ahead unless the hostages are released, but President Isaac Herzog calls those negotiations challenging.
One has to make sure that we know whether there is anybody who takes decisions on the other side. After all, you're dealing with people who are being hidden and scattered all around Gaza, mostly in the tunnels.
Meanwhile, a California woman is being held by the Russian government on suspicion of treason. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller says the U.S. wants access to her.
Russia does not recognize dual citizenship, considers them to be Russian citizens first and foremost. And so oftentimes we have a difficult time getting consular assistance, but we will pursue it in all matters where a U.S. citizen is detained.
As the Republican South Carolina primary nears, Nikki Haley is using the ages of President Joe Biden and former President Donald Trump to sway her home state's voters.
Trump and Biden are two old men who are only getting older. Nearly 60% of Americans say Trump and Biden are both too old to be president, because they are.
Polls still show Trump leading her by double digits. Haley says she's in the race until Super Tuesday. Early primary voting has started in Michigan, a state Biden narrowly won in 2020. Michigan progressive Rashida Tlaib is urging people there to vote uncommitted to protest Biden's handling of the Israel-Hamas war.
Right now, we feel completely neglected and just unseen by our government. If you want us to be louder, then come here and vote uncommitted.
Tlaib says she wants to see the White House become firm in its demands for Palestinian safety and self-determination. But meanwhile, Biden's electric vehicle mandate has become a regular talking point for Trump, who calls it a hit on the auto industry.
A vote for Biden is a vote to send tens of thousands of Michigan jobs to China and other places that we don't want them to go. A vote for Trump is a vote to keep those manufacturing jobs in America and add a lot of jobs.
The New York Times reports the White House is planning to relax the mandate's rapid timetable at the request of the big car makers and the United Auto Workers. I'm Edwin J. Vieira for Pacifica Network and Public News Service.
You're listening to KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth interview with Jeremiah Hayden from Street Roots about his latest article. It's on the Portland Business Alliance-run Downtown Enhanced Service District. At 6, Sea Change Radio. At 6:30, it's Free Culture Radio with host Doug McVeigh. Then at 7, Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with an overnight low of 44 degrees. Tomorrow's weather will be partly sunny with a high of 57. Today in history, in 1947, Edwin Land demonstrates the first instant camera, the Polaroid Land Camera, to a meeting of the Optical Society of America in New York City. The quote of the day is from British poet W.H. Auden, born this day in 1907. He said, quote, "Whatever the field is under discussion, those who engage in debate must not only believe in each other, in each other's good faith, but to also the capacity to arrive at truth."
Amazon is arguing in a legal filing made last week that the 88-year-old National Labor Relations Board, or NLRB, is unconstitutional. The filing is in response to a case that alleges the company retaliated unlawfully against workers in a New York City warehouse who voted to unionize 2 years ago. Amazon denied any wrongdoing. The case echoes similar claims made earlier this year by aerospace company SpaceX and grocery store chain Trader Joe's. They both have challenged the NLRB's constitutionality in their own unfair labor practice cases. The companies say that the limits on removing the board's administrative judges and board members violates the separation of powers and are unconstitutional. The growing number of challenges to the labor board make it more possible the issue will eventually make its way to the Supreme Court. The conservative majority on the court has signaled it may be willing to undercut other federal agencies. Seth Goldstein is an attorney. attorney who represents both the Amazon Labor Union and the Trader Joe's labor group. He said, quote, since they can't defeat successful union organizing, they now want to just destroy the whole process, end quote. He added that he found the trend, quote, very frightening, and that the pending cases could embolden other employers to refuse to negotiate with unions in the belief that courts will eventually strip the NLRB of its enforcement powers. The NLRB was founded in 1935, and it has the authority to supervise labor union elections and to investigate and remedy unfair labor practices. Amazon has faced more than 250 NLRB complaints for unlawful labor practices across the country in recent years.
The trial of an Anchorage man accused of double murder continues this week. He is on trial for the murder of two Alaskan Native women, and advocates say the case is awakening old trauma associated with missing and murdered Indigenous people. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. The trial of Brian Smith, a man accused in the murders of two Alaska Native women, resumed Tuesday in Anchorage. Last week, jurors saw cell phone videos of the murder of 30-year-old Kathleen Jo Henry and heard Smith admit to police that he killed another woman, 52-year-old Veronica Abouchuk. As the trial got underway 2 weeks ago, the prosecutor apologized to the jury for the horrific images they would see that might live on in their heads long after the trial. And for those who are not in the courtroom, KNBA's Rhonda McBride looks at why this trial could, for some, awaken old traumas. A warning, the details of this story are graphic and disturbing and include an offensive term.
Advocates for missing and murdered Indigenous people say the Brian Smith case is part of an ongoing pattern made worse by historical trauma.
I hope ultimately that we as a state and we as a community do a better job of respecting all human lives.
Like many Alaska Natives, Michael Livingston has been following the Brian Smith trial, which is being covered in the newspapers, local television, and streamed live on Court TV. Last week, the courtroom was rearranged so that the TV monitors faced away from the gallery, so only the jury, Brian Smith, and those involved in the trial could watch the last moments of Kathleen Jo Henry's life, which Smith is accused of recording on his cell phone. Everyone else in the courtroom could hear the sounds of Henry being tormented and taunted in a Midtown hotel room as she lay dying.
The title of my presentation this morning is Serial Killers in Alaska.
It's a presentation that Michael Livingston gave on Zoom last week about the connection between modern serial killings and Alaska's long history of dehumanizing Indigenous peoples, which he traces back to the late 1700s when the Russians, in hot pursuit of the fur trade, enslaved or killed the Unangak people in the Aleutian chain. Livingston says the Russians called Native people savages, as did the colonists who followed them.
And savage is a code word for non-human beings.
He says serial killers today capitalize on society's lack of caring for the most vulnerable among us.
That's wrong thinking.
Livingston says the Brian Smith murder trial is a chance for all of us to do some soul searching, not just about the women in this case, but their many sisters who have also suffered at the hands of other perpetrators. In Anchorage, I'm Rhonda McBride.
Livingston recommends people call 988, a crisis line, if details from this story or any other MMIP case reawakens trauma. Principal Chief of the Cherokee Nation in Oklahoma, Chuck Hoskin Jr., says he's heartbroken over the death of Nex Benedict, a student who died earlier this month. The 16-year-old's mother told The Independent Nex was being bullied over their gender identity and died a day after a fight at school. In a statement Tuesday, Hoskin called the death a tragedy and has asked Cherokee marshals to support in the investigation into the death. Hoskin stated the Cherokee Nation database has no indication Nex was a citizen of the tribe, but said Nex was a child living within the reservation and deserved love, support, and to be kept safe. The investigation is ongoing. The Catawba Nation has reacquired 32 acres of land in Lancaster, South Carolina. According to the tribe, the land was given back by the state. The tribe plans to seek land into trust by the federal government. It's located near the reservation and is sacred and home to a historic village site. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
This happens to be National Teen Dating Violence Awareness and Prevention Month. Advocates say that promoting welcoming communities is key to preventing teen dating violence. Eric Tegedoff has the details in Idaho.
February is National Teen Dating Violence Awareness and Prevention Month, and young people often find it hard to navigate experiences of harm. According to CDC data from 2021, nearly 16% of Idaho youth surveyed said they'd experienced sexual violence, higher than the national average of 11%. Dee Dagundon-Teagues with the Idaho Coalition Against Sexual and Domestic Violence says sexual violence is a result of imbalances in power.
The tools that we have to prevent sexual violence within our communities is promoting communities that are welcoming of everyone, where everyone has what they need to be able to participate in their community, like school, so that they're not targeted and the power imbalance is mitigated.
Teague says there are domestic and sexual violence programs across the state, but more are needed, especially in rural communities. They also note that members of LGBTQIA+ communities and people of color are more likely to experience this kind of violence. The rate of teen dating violence is likely much higher. Teague says one of the biggest issues, especially when it comes to reporting, is that young people don't feel heard.
Young people are not likely to tell a trusted adult when they experience sexual violence. They're more likely to tell a peer because adults dismiss the kind of dating violence that is happening with young people.
For someone who has experienced this kind of trauma, Teague says it's important to ask what they need and help that person reestablish their agency. They also add that healing takes time.
It's easy for us to be supportive at the beginning, but a consistent, ongoing, supportive community and people who care about them, because sexual violence and dating violence requires a long time to heal from.
For Northern Rockies News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
Older student loan borrowers across the country have a chance to participate in a one-time payment count adjustment, but must take action before April 30th. An expert contends that the initiative could help change lives and ease the burden of student loans for many. Alex Gonzalez has the story in Nevada.
Student loan borrowers of all ages in Nevada and around the country have an opportunity to have their student loans canceled or the chance to receive credits towards loan forgiveness, but action will be needed soon. The U.S. Department of Education will be conducting a one-time payment count adjustment this coming summer. Cora Hume is an attorney with the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau and says student loan debt doesn't discriminate. The average student loan debt for more than 50,000 older borrowers in the Silver State is just under $44,000, according to the Education Data Initiative. Hume says borrowers who have non-federally held loans must consolidate them into a direct consolidation loan with the Department of Education by April 30th to reap the potential benefits.
Older borrowers are less likely to hold direct loans, which would already benefit from this pay count adjustment. And then those that do own direct loans, they're less likely to participate in this IDR program that caps their monthly payments based on family size and income.
Hume says the Department of Education will give borrowers credit through its income-driven repayment program for repayment periods from July 1, 1994. She adds that 32% of older borrowers are struggling to pay their bills, which is why she encourages folks to call 1-800-433-3243 or visit studentaid.gov/loan consolidation to find out if they're eligible for the significant adjustment. Hume says nationally there are 1.1 million older borrowers that are not in the direct loan program and hold an average debt of $29,500 in student debt.
The three loans that must be consolidated to receive this payment count adjustment is the commercially managed federally family education loans, the health and education assistance loans, and Perkins loans. Another loan that sort of is a quasi need for consolidation are Parent PLUS loans.
Hume says the upcoming deadline has the potential to change lives and suggests taking action sooner rather than later. For Nevada News Service, I'm Alex Gonzalez.
It's Wednesday, and that means a visit with KBOO News poet Dan Raphael. Tonight, Dan says the question isn't what happened, but what's next?
News clusters make me nervous. First, Donnie says he'll sick Putin on NATO. Then U.S. intelligence discovers a Russian space weapon, and Putin assassinates Navalny. What's next? McBorscht at McDonald's? A vaccine for the Russian flu no one's caught yet? Iranian drones sold to NATO and Israel? It's like a bad political thriller, but spread across months instead of hours, and no Jason Bourne or Tom Cruise to cheer for. Donnie will stay in the race. He needs the campaign funds to pay his legal bills, and soon his daughter-in-law will head the Republican Party and open those bank accounts to Donnie, making the Republican Party bankrupt financially as well as morally. And the Democrats? They're waiting for the billionaires to send more of the money their way, unaware that the rich have realized the only parties they need are the ones they give themselves. And I don't want to know who will celebrate Julian Assange's extradition to America, or will they wait until his death in a U.S. prison? For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, February 21st, 2024. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news stories, tips, and ideas at 971-245-2158. Our production team for tonight's newscast includes Chris Gao, Dan Raphael, Lisa Luffing, and Joseph. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Ray Bodwell. Special thanks to Eric Tegadoff, Antonia Gonzalez, Edwin J. Vieira, Alex Gonzalez, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Michelle Coppola.
And I'm James Neal. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm speaking with Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, about his latest article. It's called City Adopts Enhanced Service District Recommendations Amid Criticism. The Portland Business Alliance contract requires buy-in, offers little transparency. Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.